I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Tonight Show. The political blame game. After a historic loss for the coalition in last week's referenda, we have the latest on the fallout.
The dogs should be brought back as soon as possible to discuss this. I understand that ministers are flitting away to the four corners of the world at the moment.
People said we're happy with the existing provisions in the constitution.
And as the beginning of Ramadan fails to ease hostilities in the Middle East, we speak with the UK ambassador about the ongoing conflict. Plus, Monarch's Mother's Day mishap. Princess of Wales Kate Middleton apologises for photoshopping a family picture released on Mother's Day. Well, in a pretty bruising defeat for the government, the referendums on family and care were emphatically rejected by the Irish public over the weekend. The political fallout has been swift, with some questioning whether a weary electorate was put off by wordy, woke proposals, while others have cited legal concerns and government apathy. Well, here to discuss the potential political ramifications of these results is Fianna Fáil Senator Malcolm Byrne, Fine Gael Senator Mary Searle Kearney, in Ireland Independent TD Michael Fitzmaurice, journalist with the Irish Independent Sarah Carey, and Business Post editor Daniel McConnell. You're all very welcome to the programme. I'm going to come to you first, Daniel, because we've now had about 48 hours to digest this, actually a bit more because the result was pretty clear on Saturday morning. What was the feeling in Leinster House today?
Well, I get the sense from within the coalition there's a lot of recrimination within the parties. Willie O'Dea coming out, the veteran TD former minister, basically saying Fianna Fáil needs to get back to basics, you know, scrap the hate speech bill, stop listening to the woke brigade, stop listening to the Greens and the NGOs and start building houses, etc. like that. You've got the Green Party sending out notes to their own base saying, blaming Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael for not doing their part in the electorate or in the campaign. And you've a Fine Gael party, quite frankly, in disarray. You've a lethargic-looking Taoiseach who hasn't really looked energised for a single moment since he's been back in the office since December 2022. They are really showing the signs of being in government since 2011.
So they're all blaming each other, yeah. But do they have an understanding as to why the electorate rejected these referenda so comprehensively?
Well, I think there's an exception, a reluctant acceptance, that those who were primarily in charge of running the campaign, the directors of election, simply dropped the ball and dropped the ball massively. You know, when various expletives are being used by senior cabinet ministers speaking to me in the last 24, 48 hours, you know, describing it as a nightmare, a SHIT show. And beyond that, you're kind of looking at a disbelief almost as to how could it have gone so badly wrong? But I think, you know, when your director of elections, Heather Humphreys, doesn't do a single broadcast interview and doesn't do a single newspaper interview during the duration of the campaign, that speaks volumes. And I think also as well when, you know, Yes campaigners and teams of Yes campaigners are telling you within 4 or 5 days of the vote happening, their canvassers aren't going to the doors because they're afraid of being stumped by difficult questions and they don't have good enough answers for it. And you've government TDs basically giving out that their yes posters are being put up in their constituencies, which knowing they're going to have to defend them post a defeat, speaks just to how chaotic really the handling of this referendum was.
Do you accept also that the wording, the basic wording that was put to the people was poorly drafted, Michael?
Absolutely. I think there was a lot of ambiguity about it. When you saw the debates in your own programme here and indeed other stations, You know, the yes side weren't able to defend or give definitive answers to anything. The one thing, though, that I really don't admire over the last 2 days about government, and they're like rats in a barrel, we'd say, down the country eating each other up at the moment, is that they believe that the people are nearly the minnows, that they put something forward, that you're supposed to go with this. Well, that's not the way it should be. We are a sovereign state. People have the right to decide yes or no. Let's not have these all these ramifications. This country needs to move on. A post-mortem is over. We have huge problems. Today, this evening, news is after breaking that a 600-square-foot modular home is costing $337,000. We have a housing crisis. We have farmers under real pressure. We have rural Ireland, in my opinion, being neglected. And here we are doing a post-mortem because the people didn't do what the three parties believed they should have done. And on top of that, what Sinn Féin and other parties in opposition believed they should have done. Let's give people credit. They understood what they were looking at. If in doubt, kick it out. And that's what the people done in this referendum.
So it wasn't that people were confused at all?
Absolutely not. Because, you know, durable was the one word that everybody couldn't get a straight answer about. I spoke to a person this evening on the way up on a phone that 21 years ago they gave up their job because they're caring for their young child. Because their husband had an income, they never got a penny. Is that looking after people with disabilities? You don't need to go to the Constitution to change that. What you can do is put in the measures to help those people, and we never have done them down through the years.
Mary Ciarán Kearney, it was a staggering defeat from this government. Was it down to a pretty, as Daniel would say, a pretty lacklustre campaign? A pretty chaotic campaign, I think actually you said, Daniel.
I think that certainly the people have spoken. I'm glad we're in a democracy where the people get a right to say no and their government respects what they have to say. Did we convince the people of, first of all, the necessity for the two propositions that was put before the people? Clearly not. And I think that people voted no for a multiplicity of reasons. They either thought that the wording didn't go far enough, or they thought that the wording was not necessary, or that they disagreed, they didn't want to change, or else that they didn't accept the wording that was put before them and felt that it left an ambiguity. So that is our fault for not communicating that, for not explaining that. I certainly had a number of our councillors ringing me from around the country as matters came up on the doors.
Were you out actively campaigning?
Yes, I was. And I did as much media as I could possibly do to try and put over and explain where we were at.
Because do you accept what Daniel said? Others didn't, because they actually weren't sure how to answer the questions being put to them.
I think that the propositions and the needs were not communicated adequately enough. I agree with that. But the fact is that tonight, a million people are in families around this country that their constitution doesn't recognise them and give them the authority of family status that they deserve. So we need to address that deficit now and the fact that they are left without.
What about Willie O'Dea's comments and actually Lisa Chambers' comments this evening, both coming out saying, we voted no on this. We weren't convinced either.
Every Wednesday, members of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and other parties, but they're the two that I definitively know, have the privilege of walking into a room with their party leader, who is either the Taoiseach or the Tánaiste, and the ministers and the ministers of state. And you are free in our democracy to stand up and say whatever you do. I believe it's my duty every week, actually, to go in and represent the people of Dublin South Central and say, these are the concerns that are coming up for me.
And they didn't do this.
There is no point coming out on the day after the people have voted no and say, well, I didn't vote no, and that they didn't accept that proposition, or that they didn't have a duty to raise that in their parliamentary parties. Furthermore, Lisa Chambers is responsible for the setting of the Shannon agenda. She is responsible for that. So the idea that she was confused, that she didn't accept, from the day one, she agreed the guillotine. She agreed the timing in the Shannon. Mm. So I'm very disappointed in her. I thought much more of her. The idea of coming out after the event, I find it lacks political courage. I'm here to say I advocated strongly for a yes. I will continue to advocate for the needs that brought about those yes. And stand by the fact that did we make mistakes? Clearly we did, absolutely. And we take that vehemently on the chin.
But it wasn't...
But that's what you must do.
It wasn't just Lisa Chambers, though, and it wasn't just Willie O'Dea, it wasn't just Fianna Fáil, because we had Joe O'Brien saying at the weekend it would have been good to see more people knocking on doors. He said, from our point of view in the Green Party, we got people out, but I'm not sure what the other parties were doing. Well, so are the Fianna Fáil, Greens, Fine Gaels turning on each other on this?
I think the Minister, Mary Butler, was excellent. She communicated excellently. She was very good. I did a show with her and she couldn't have been clearer. And she goes, so there are individuals who actually did extremely well during this. Should more have been done? Well, clearly. I mean, people didn't understand and didn't...
Did Fine Gael
they didn't
do
have
because...
their fears allayed. I think that there were genuine fears arose, and it was up to us to meet those fears, to allay the concerns regarding inheritance, regarding other issues. You know, I think Mary Butler did that extremely well. I tried to do it as well as I possibly could, you know, and there were other of us that came out. There were people canvassing. There were photographs on social media this evening of the very people who said they never canvassed, actually out canvassing for yes, yes, and claiming that they voted no, which is a peculiarity. Government is about making tough decisions. Not everybody agrees with them. Not everybody likes them. Mm-hmm. But it is important that we do make decisions. We won't always get it right.
You seem frustrated, Mary, that people are coming out now trying to distance themselves from this result.
I think that being in government means that you have to take tough decisions and that you have to stand by that. There is a responsibility to stand by the decisions that you make, whether they are good or bad. And then clearly in this instance, people didn't agree with us.
Okay,
and
Malcolm
didn't
Byrne,
fully take on the propositions that were put before them.
These are your colleagues trying to distance themselves from defeat.
Well, I think what they're doing is they're expressing, you know, their perspective on the campaign.
After the fact.
I voted yes and yes. I do think, and I would agree with colleagues, the government fails to communicate. The people were correct then in making their decision that those of us who advocated a yes vote did not convince people of the merits of the proposition.
But it's not that you just didn't convince people. We've heard this evening you didn't convince two members of Fianna Fáil, Willie O'Dea, a veteran TD, and Lisa Chambers, who's running for Europe. So the two pretty prominent members of Fianna Fáil coming out saying, we voted no, no. It's hardly a ringing endorsement for the assurances that the Taoiseach gave Micheál Martin about this referenda.
Yeah, and I will say, and I mean, as Mary has mentioned, in terms of the Fine Gael parliamentary party discussions, certainly there were doubts expressed within Fianna Fáil parliamentary party discussions. Daniel in the past would have had an ears to some of those discussions and would have been able to pick them up.
So you say in those meetings, in those parliamentary party meetings of a Wednesday evening, did you hear Willie O'Dea, did you hear Lisa Chambers saying, we're confused, we're not sure, we might vote no?
Among a number of my parliamentary colleagues, what we were reflecting were certainly some of the issues that were coming up and some of the concerns. And I don't think there is any one reason as to why people voted no. And it's very difficult, you know, for people to say it is because of this reason. But I think certainly the fact that there were so many questions being asked about the propositions, and when people are not certain about the impact of the changes of the constitution, then they were much more likely to vote no. And I certainly know that. And it wasn't, I think, the majority of those, for instance, on the family referendum, they very much recognise the fact that there are families that are not the traditional families based on marriage, and they do believe that through legislation they should be respected. The problem was, and I think Michael was right, the issue was around the use of the word durable. And I was certainly getting questions back around what exactly did that mean? And then there were questions about... So let's just, say a partner
just
left
to be
somebody.
Clear, just to be clear, because it is two of your Fianna Fáil colleagues who have said they voted no. Did they raise concerns and were their concerns not addressed?
Well, I think it's fair to say that a number of colleagues would have raised concerns during the campaign.
Who else raised concerns?
Around. Well, it's not for me to obviously speak on, you know, what happens internally within parliamentary party meetings. But what I will say is some of those concerns were raised. I think it's, you know, we're an open democratic party, so it's important that that happens. I think challenge, well, I think that's where we failed, because where a lot of the questions that came up And this I would even argue around the, you know, the Attorney General's advice. I'm less concerned in one sense about, you know, whether it should be released or not. But certainly when Rossa Fanning prepared his advice, he raised a number of questions that, in a sense, you know, the Yes campaign, government campaign, should have been in a position, whether it was published or not, say, look, these are going to be very legitimate questions that are going to be raised, so we should be in a position to answer it.
Actually, is it not a fair point, Sarah Carey, and it was raised again by Lisa Chambers when she was in Drive Time this evening, that the advice that was published by The Ditch on Thursday night from the Attorney General, that it was in conflict with some of the answers that ministers gave about the impact of these two referenda?
It flat out contradicted it, and there's going to have to be fallout for that. But I came on this programme tonight to say one thing. The people who voted against the referendum, especially the mother one, we're not members of the far right.
Correct.
We're not confused. We're not misinformed.
Correct.
And if every single cabinet minister had walked up to my front door and asked me to vote for it, I wasn't going to vote for it because I was not deleting mothers from the Constitution. And so many mothers contacted me and wrote to me about that aspect, which I addressed in one of my columns. It has been almost completely excluded from the analysis. And Maria Steen, who took on the Taoiseach and beat him in that debate, wasn't interviewed by any mainstream media on Saturday. So I had to watch an interview with her on the Gripped platform. Now,
okay,
what does
but we
that
did,
say?
In fairness, Sarah Carey.
Well,
in
I
fairness,
did ask.
We did, and I'm sure every other media organisation voted or spoke to people from the no side
but
right throughout
the
this
aspect
campaign,
of mothers is very important, and I want to say
very
this.
Very important to you. We don't actually know how many people it was important.
Okay, well, I
we
want to read out. This
yet.
Was a text I got from a cousin of mine who sent it to me on Saturday, and she said, my whole circle of friends, work colleagues, Facebook friends, who are all mothers and all ends of the social structure in society, were most annoyed at the mother component. And I think that has been excluded far too much from the debate.
Do you see this as a swing back then?
No, I don't.
Or a fight back to a more conservative Ireland?
No.
Because the sense was that we'd become more and more
liberal. No, not at all. And I was at a business networking meeting this morning for women, and professional women were saying to me there, of course I voted no. One woman said to me, if it wasn't in the Constitution, I'd be fighting to put it in. Mothers are exhausted. They are exhausted working. They're exhausted looking after their children. They're exhausted keeping up to a standard that they can't meet. And the National Women's Council of Ireland does not represent them.
Correct.
And the
government
listens to
you. Do you want to back in here, Mary, briefly?
Since 1996, we have had a campaign coming at us as politicians saying that they wanted that wording and that particular provision in the Constitution removed or amended. I thought the Taoiseach actually reflected it very well today in saying, well, maybe we overestimated the strength of the people's view with regard to the removal of that, because it was taken as read that given that the campaign had gone on for over 30 years to remove it, that it would be removal. We had a citizens' assembly that wanted it removed. So there was an impetus there and a momentum behind removing it.
Okay,
I think
we have a citizens' assembly. It's called the Dáil. And they're the people who are supposed to legislate for this amendment. And maybe if the TDs had talked to the women of Ireland, and even within the Irish Independent Group that I write for, there were so many women who were voting no, who had voted yes to repeal the 8th and voted yes for same-sex marriage. Sinead Ryan, Lorraine Courtney, myself, Larissa Nolan in the Mirror, and we were ignored. We're not being ignored.
Well, I don't know if you were ignored if you look at the results.
By the political establishment.
I'm convinced, Ciara, that if the proposition have been put as three questions instead of two, that the vote to remove that piece wouldn't actually have been passed.
Okay.
I do think Sarah is actually correct, because I sort of got the feeling about 7 to 8 days out, both of these are going to go down. And that is in many ways when those of us in the political bubble, you know, we're always engaged in these issues, but a lot of voters will only make up their mind on a referendum coming up to the vote. And certainly, I think Sarah's right. I was certainly hearing it back from people about, you know, removing the word mother. And this was from people who would have defined themselves as liberal. So it certainly wasn't a far-right issue, because a lot of people who voted yes for marriage equality and abortion. I think the other issue, which was crucial, was the question that was raised by a lot of disability activists, a lot of people who I respect, and they were very serious concerns. And the word strive did become an issue. And it comes back to when there was doubt around the wording And this wasn't around, you know, a lot of the intention behind some of the legislation or whatever. When there was doubt around the wording, people were going to say, no, we're going to leave well
enough. What about the point being made, which I think you addressed there briefly, Sarah, that politicians throughout this campaign, ministers, were expressing an opinion that was not in line with the advice that had been given from the Attorney General? And you can see that very, very clearly, Malcolm Byrne, when you read the advice that the Ditch published.
Yeah, so first of all...
Did they mislead people? Because that's what Alan Chatter was saying this evening. They were misled intentionally by Cabinet.
Well, first of all, you've got to remember that, you know, it is the Attorney General and he is offering advice, and it is the same way as any lawyer can offer you a piece of advice. I accept that he's the government legal officer.
So when Micheál Martin was out on his debate saying that he was certain that single mothers were included in the definition of durable relationships, I think people would have assumed that that was based on the legal advice from the government, and it wasn't.
Yes, and there were certainly lawyers who were saying that this would have covered, but there was always going to be a case...
But not the Attorney General.
But this is actually where the crucial point is. And it's where I think people had doubts was, if it did end up then before the courts, what would happen? Now, we have a lot of legislation in place. And remember, the Constitution...
OK, now, just to address the point, was Micheál Martin right to come out and make that statement?
I think it was a fair statement for him to make, because the intention behind the amendment was about recognising single parents. And it is important, and I think it is important that as a state that we recognise...
Yeah, yes, no, we do all know that, but he would have given you the indication that this statement, durable relationships, definitely included single mothers, and the Attorney General's advice saying, I can't guarantee that.
Well, of course the Attorney General...
So was he misled?
If you go to, I think it's very rare. I mean, you know, the old line about if you could only have a one-armed lawyer who would, you know, offer you advice. Lawyers will always say, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, there is always the possibility, which the Attorney General was correct to say, that if this ended up before the courts, questions would have arisen. The intention behind, and this is what the Taoiseach made very clear, the intention behind it was to protect those families that are not necessarily
Okay. He didn't say that was the intention. He said that was going to be the outcome. Do we also need to look at some of the civil society groups here? Michael Fitzmaurice, Ellen Coyne was writing at the weekend. She said they receive a lot of taxpayers' money to advocate in our best interests, many of whom took a yes position, which is totally at odds with what the public want.
Yeah, well, look at Independent Ireland, and we got criticised for it. I think there's something like 33,000 different NGOs getting $6.5 billion. I was on your programme here, but some people tried to twist it. I think a review needs to be done. The finger was off the pulse with the Women's Council of Ireland. I think they have an awful lot to answer for. And how many more? Some disability groups came out and said go for a yes vote. And I think they have questions to answer as well. Is government being driven by a certain cohort of people? And obviously the government didn't want to listen to the Attorney General's advice. So they drove on, they rammed it through the Dáil. There was no respect for the political system. And, you know, they got their answer. And I think, to be honest about it, we need to move on and deal with the problems we have,
Sarah,
at the moment.
It wasn't
instead, I do want to stick with that,
and we will come back to all of those issues we do regularly on this programme. It wasn't just the NGOs and it wasn't just the coalition, though, was it? It was the majority of opposition parties all advocated a yes vote here. Are they damaged by this?
Oh, absolutely. And particularly Sinn Féin. Now, I felt sorry for Mary Lou McDonald when she was going into Dublin Castle and she...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
who's been heckled by some clearly nasty elements who were there, you know, and that shouldn't be going on. But they were in the Dáil and they supported it and they proved that they were just as out of touch as the government were. Mm. And what another...
And it wasn't just them, it was the Labour
Party. But
what
a lot of other women... What a lot of other women have said to me is, who do we vote for now? Who actually represents us? And that's the big problem the government has, because I know there were some political analysis and people like Daniel were saying, look, it'll be over in 3 days and life will move on. But I think women are so angry about this that it's not going to be that simple. And the government is going to have to show us that actually we are appreciated and something. And let's remember this as well. Now, I voted for Tom Clonan in the Trinity Senate. I'm a Trinity graduate and I, you know, will support anything that he says. But there's nothing in the Constitution that prevents the government from doing something for carers. Right. We all know that. And they try to take us for fools and to vote for, to make them do something that they can do anyway. Mm. So crack on with the job, build houses. That is the big factor from which all these other downstream elements are running from, like anti-immigration, like problems for students, like two parents having to go out to work and be exhausted when one...
Can I just say one thing?
Do you want to let Daniel back in here? Yeah. Do you think this does, Daniel, have long-term impacts, this emphatic rejection of these two provisions?
So the atmosphere in the political system was getting more and more febrile because during the last year of an election, you've got the three parties in government trying to kind of, you know, eke out an identity, you know, separate to their coalition partners. This absolutely further destabilised that relationship. Look at the backbiting, the bitching and the sniping that's already going on. That's only going to escalate. You've a pretty finite legislative programme left in terms of, you know, actually, so all the pet projects that have been on the back burner, you know, they're now going to be scrambling to get on. So this is where the shit's really going to hit the fan, quite frankly, when it comes to relations within government. I think ultimately, if the three leaders can hold it together and the two finance ministers, Michael McGrath and Pascal Dunhill, the ship will stay.
Does it set a certain tone coming up to the local and European elections, do you think?
It's a durable relationship. The three parties will continue to work because the focus has to be on housing and health.
Like, I don't think the government's, you know, in threat of falling today or tomorrow or the next day. What it does do is it just heightens the potential for an unforeseen sort of calamity coming up and the government falling over that. That's all it does. It raises the temperature a little bit.
Very briefly, I only have about 20 seconds here. The next referenda, you're going to be overseeing that. What lesson have you learnt?
So it's on the European Unified Patent System. I think one of the challenges is, first of all, communicating it to people. But I think the big difference is there's a very clear outcome here. The question is, does Ireland join the European Unified Patent System? Okay. It's a very clear yes, no. And I don't think you'll see the level of ambiguity that we would have seen in the referendum that we've just had.
With an economic advantage, if we vote yes in that. But we will continue the job of inequality, of addressing inequalities, continue the job of raising the case for carers, as we have been all along, for people with disabilities.
With due respect, Michael, you will never be in a position, you've backed away from the position, and you will never have to take responsibility. If you look at the people, because you didn't know the mood of the people.
Well, you didn't take responsibility either.
Go into government with.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the other.
Whoever agrees to the programme for government that you have in your document, that's who you go to government.
Unfortunately, I have to leave it.
We're working very hard on our programme
there for now. But my thanks to Malcolm Byrne, to Mary Seary Kearney, to Michael Fitzmaurice, to Sarah Carey, and to Daniel McConnell. Thanks to you all for coming into studio this evening. Coming up, the UK Ambassador Paul Johnson on a recent report that found British spy Steak Knife probably cost more lives than he saved while undercover in the IRA. Do stay with us. President Michael D. Higgins has issued a blistering statement criticising the blocking of humanitarian aid and medical supplies from Gaza. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of people marched in central London this weekend calling for an immediate ceasefire in the region. The UK ambassador to Ireland, Paul Johnson, joins us to discuss this and more. Ambassador, you're very welcome to the programme. It is, of course, the first day of Ramadan in that region, and President Joe Biden had hoped it would signal the beginning of a ceasefire, and that hasn't happened. How would you sum up the situation there right now?
it's a dire situation and we are increasingly concerned about it. We had shared the hope as well of getting a pause in the fighting. Our government has been arguing for a long time now that we needed to get a cessation of the fighting. We needed to take the urgent steps necessary to translate that into a sustainable ceasefire, which includes getting more aid in, which is urgently needed, getting the remaining hostages out, getting Hamas out of control in Gaza with a reinvigorated Palestinian Authority, and setting a meaningful path towards a two-state solution. Now, that's a lot to be done in a short period of time, but the urgency is clearly growing by the day. We are engaged with Cyprus, America, the UAE, other countries, the European Commission, to try and establish an urgent humanitarian corridor into Gaza. But we recognise, and we've been very clear with the Israelis as well, that there needs to be urgent action taken because the humanity situation is dire and getting worse by the day.
Our President Michael D. Higgins criticised what he said was a propaganda campaign against the United Nations, and he called on countries to increase the aid that they are giving to UNRWA. Now, obviously, at the moment, the UK and the US have ceased funding or paused funding to UNRWA. He said by doing that, that some of these countries need to bear the responsibility, really, for the deaths that will follow.
So we've been a big funder to UNRWA over the years. I spent 3 years working on the UN Security Council in New York, and we were one of the biggest contributors to UNRWA. But there was these very serious allegations about the involvement of UNRWA personnel in the terrible attacks on the 7th of October. There's an internal UN investigation going on. The former French foreign minister has been asked to do a review, an urgent review of the neutrality and the allegations. So we're very keen to see the humanitarian effort stepped up. That's why we're doing all these various initiatives.
But there is a quarter of the country a step away from the famine. Why withhold aid from an agency that is trying to help those people?
Because there are serious allegations that have been raised against the agency. It's not just the Americans and the UK. There's a number of countries who've suspended their funding pending that. We would like to see the situation cleared up. We'd like to be able to reinvest in UNRWA. We recognise the important job it's done over time, but we also have to be clear that the people who are working there are doing the job that they're properly required to do, and there aren't people there who are doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
Well, do you assume that you will begin the funding to UNRWA again once those reports are
published? We want to be in a position where we can restore funding, because it is the agency on the ground. It has a distribution network. It has other assets. But while these very serious allegations are being investigated, we took the decision to pause the funding. But we'd like to be in a situation to restore that as soon as we can.
Israel has consistently said that they are not impeding aid into Gaza. Do you believe them?
Our ministers have given the Israeli government very clear and very tough messages. I think David Cameron called them tough but necessary measures about the need to facilitate humanitarian access. And we continue to press on that.
So they are impeding aid. Do you accept that?
We have been clear all the way through that more can be done to allow aid in, and we continue to make those points very clearly.
You wrote a letter to the Irish Times, didn't you, just before Christmas, and you said the calls for a ceasefire there, and we see thousands of people marching in London, but you said those calls were unrealistic and even unwise. Do you still stand by that?
I mean, diplomacy is a profession in which you can sometimes get tied up in knots about language. But what I said in that letter and what I said in a radio interview a few weeks before was that you need to distinguish really between two things. One is to get a pause in the fighting as soon as possible, and we want an immediate pause. But a ceasefire to be durable, not to collapse the day after or a few days after, needs to have various ingredients. So it needs to have Hamas no longer in control of Gaza. It needs to have aid flows going in and the hostages coming out. It needs to have a reinvigorated Palestinian Authority which can exercise meaningful and inclusive governance in Gaza. And it needs to have, for all sides, the perspective of a political solution. So you're not going to get that just by saying we're calling a ceasefire. You need a sort of series of steps to move from a pause in the fighting into something that's durable and lasting. So I think it's at some degree it's semantics, but at some degree it's an important distinction to say we want the fighting to stop as soon as possible, but we don't want it to stop for 24 hours and then just relapse into violence. You need to create the conditions whereby you can make that into a permanent ceasefire. And that's not going to be done overnight, sadly.
You've said that you want to see this peace process rebooted, and you've said that Hamas could never be a partner for peace. You talk about the Palestinian Authority being re-established in that area. Does the UK government really see Benjamin Netanyahu as a partner for peace?
We think that clearly the Israeli government is fundamental to this. We've been very clear that the perspective of a two-state solution needs to be re-established. It's been one of the sort of paradoxes of international politics for 50-plus years that the international community has defined the parameters of a two-state solution, but we haven't got into a situation where we've got Israeli and Palestinian partners ready to work for it. So I'm not going to comment on internal Israeli politics, but what I am going to say is we firmly believe, I know the European Union as a whole does, the Americans do, Arab countries do, that we need to get a credible perspective for peace. The Foreign Secretary has said we are prepared to look at recognition of a Palestinian state in order to contribute to that process. So we need some urgent new thinking and we need some urgent commitment to real progress from Israel and from the Palestinians. But do you think
there is that political will within Israel, with a pretty right-wing government, and Benjamin Netanyahu seem to reject the idea of a two-state solution at the minute?
I mean, if you think what the Israelis suffered on the 7th of October, the equivalent of multiple 9/11s, you can understand why, for them, this existential sense of their security is absolutely central. So we've got to be in a position to sort of reassure both sides that there will be a secure and viable prospect of a Palestinian state, but that Israel will be able to live with that state in security. So that's why a lot of diplomacy, a lot of clever thinking is required. So I think neither, I suspect, the Israeli government and wider Israeli public opinion, nor Palestinian opinion at the moment, would look at the situation with any great optimism. So in some senses, you can be tempted to say this is hopeless, but the situation is so dire and the stakes are so important that we have to push on, even though the prospects at the moment look very slim.
Ireland has been called hostile towards Israel by a number of Israeli politicians. What do you make of the position that Irish politicians have taken in relation to this war?
Well, it's always a good rule for an ambassador not to comment on the internal politics of the country you're posted in. But I think Ireland, I know from my own time working on sort of foreign policy in the European Union, that Ireland has always had this very strong position on the Israel-Palestine issue. There's a spectrum of opinions in the international community. You've seen that with the way European countries have voted at the UN. I think Ireland has had a consistent position. I think often the differences are less obvious than they sometimes see in terms of how people vote, because we all have the same priority and we all want to see an end to this terrible violence as soon as possible. And I think Ireland has been a sort of consistent voice on that, including in the course of the current crisis.
Are you, because I know you go out and about around the country, are you surprised by the strength of feeling here, though, among ordinary people?
I think that I've been struck, you know, back in the UK, we've had massive protests. You see it across continental Europe. I think the fact that people have seen both the appalling horror of the 7th of October and terrible scenes since then, you know, in their social media, in their media, night after night, I think it's no surprise that it's... I know talking to Irish friends with young children, teenage children, people in their 20s and 30s, but all ages really, I think have been traumatised by what they've seen. So no, the strength of feeling doesn't surprise me, and that's why I think it's really important for governments and politicians to be able to rise to this challenge and get urgent action, because I think there's a real sense of public anger and despair at the situation.
I want to talk briefly about Operation Canova, that interim report which was published on Friday looking at the activities of Stake Knife, the British spy. One of the conclusions that came out of that was that the UK government and the Republican leadership need to apologise for failing to prevent torture and murder of suspected informants. Should the UK government apologise? Will they apologise?
So there's a limit to what I can say at the moment. It was an interim report. The final report is yet to be produced. There are a number of legal proceedings concerning the issues covered by Canova. So we're not in a position where we can give any definitive answers. What we can say, of course, is this was a report covering an extremely bleak period in Northern Ireland's history, appalling sectarian carnage, a really sort of horrific situation. We believe very much in the interests of getting to the bottom of what happened. Our own new proposals, legislation for addressing the legacy of the Troubles, focuses on information recovery and on reconciliation.
That's the Legacy Act.
Correct.
And we've seen the SDLP today saying that and the response to this Operation Canova report is a pathetic indictment of the government and their shabby approach to legacy.
Well, all I would say on that is that we want to be in a position to say as much as possible as soon as we can. But while there are legal proceedings outstanding, we can't comment on the detail of what's in the Canova report. But the whole thrust of our proposals is to give the families of victims, others who've been damaged by the appalling events of the Troubles, as much information and as much sort of clarity as we can. But that's, we need to wait for the final Canova report. We need to, it's a 200-page report, even the interim one. We need to study its findings very carefully. But we are committed to the process of information recovery and reconciliation.
OK, and look, we have to recognise that many of those victims that you speak about have opposed this legislation, as has the Irish government, which is now taking a legal challenge to get it. And there was a lot of discussion, particularly over Brexit, about how strained Irish-English relations had become. Has this strained them further?
I think there's a well-known difference of opinion between the Irish and British governments on this. We've been discussing it over a number of years. We'd hope to narrow the gap between us on the way forward in legacy. That didn't prove possible. We regret the fact that Ireland has taken us to the European Court of Human Rights, partly because there's a legislative process, a legal challenge going on in our own courts in Northern Ireland, which is addressing the same issues. So we thought it was unnecessary for the Irish government to take that decision, but we respect the fact that process is underway. We will defend our position robustly. But that's one important, but nevertheless, it's one issue. We cooperate across a whole range of issues, from Russia, Ukraine to climate change. The trade and relation, trade and business relationship is very strong. That's not to minimise the importance of the legacy issue, but it's one issue against a whole suite of other issues.
All right. Ambassador Paul Johnson, thank you for coming in to speak to us. We'll have to leave that conversation there
thank
for
you
now.
Very much. Lots
more to come after this break, so do please stay with us. Well, a somewhat startling revelation. Kate Middleton issued an apology today, admitting a family picture the palace posted to celebrate Mother's Day was indeed photoshopped. The image was removed by several major news organisations. This comes as many had queried the health and whereabouts of the Princess of Wales as she stood back from public life while recovering from surgery. Well, joining me with more on this is TRT world broadcaster Enda Brady. Enda, lovely to have you on the programme as always. First of all, what were the photoshopped edits? I certainly didn't see them immediately, but the more I studied the photographs, the more I could see there were things that were clearly off.
Yeah, there was a few things that really jumped out, Ciara. I think first of all was Princess Charlotte's sleeve and the hand didn't match up, and then there was the issue of Prince Louis's fingers. There's a zip on Princess of Wales's jacket. I think there's about 11 or 12 in total. Picture editors have gone through this in fine detail, and the alarm bells started ringing round about this time last night, so they pulled the picture. So we've got a royal first here, really. This is the first time they've ever put out a doctored photograph, if you like. And then today, of course, we had word from Kate Middleton, signed off with a C for Catherine, on their social media accounts, apologising for what had happened and saying that she's an amateur photographer, and like a lot of amateur photographers, she sometimes experiments with editing. So for whatever reason, she edited the photograph, which was apparently taken by her husband William last week in Windsor, but so much didn't add up. I mean, even the greenery on the tree in the background, a lot of people questioning just when was this photograph taken?
I mean, the photo was released, as we said, yesterday on Mother's Day, a beautiful photograph of her with her three children. And it was, I suppose, released to address some of the pretty wild rumours that have been doing the rounds about her absence. But it has totally backfired on them, hasn't it? It's poured further fuel on those rumours, on those social media posts that have questioned why she is absent.
Yeah, it really has. Look, Mother's Day on Sunday, it should have been the most open of PR open goals for the royal family, and they've somehow managed to score an own goal, if you like. I mean, it's bad PR, really, having to apologise and backtrack. And of course, now all the conspiracy theories are gaining even more traction online. And then we saw this afternoon William and Kate being driven out of Windsor together. He was on his way to Westminster Abbey to attend the Commonwealth Day service, and she apparently had a private appointment. So that was done, I think, deliberately to show people that she's up, she's about, she's moving, but the palace won't be commenting any further. And a lot of media now calling for the original photograph to be released. I understand that's not going to happen, but it's been a very sorry saga, and I can only imagine it's added to her stress, really, which was quite the opposite of what was intended.
Yeah, I do think it is pretty sad because she did announce at the beginning of the year that she would be taking time out from public life because she was clearly going through quite major abdominal surgery. Why has there been such thirst, I suppose, for information here and so much speculation as to why she has been absent?
Look, I think social media and the internet has driven this story, and we're seeing the palace respond. And a lot of people are saying, well, they should have lived by the mantra of the late Queen Elizabeth II. She used to say, don't complain, never explain. And this time now, they're constantly fighting a battle against social media. There's wild conspiracy theories out there, and I'm sure they're all way, way wide of the mark. We were told at the very outset that she'd had abdominal surgery, and we were told at the very beginning of that surgery that the Princess of Wales would be out of action until Easter at least. And people have been putting pressure on and coming up with these ridiculous conspiracy theories. And the palace felt that they had to act. And she obviously thought, well, the best way to show people I'm recovering is to have a nice family portrait. And look what's happened.
The wider implication here, I suppose, is that if you have these big picture agencies saying this picture has been manipulated, kill the photograph, does it feed into this whole mistrust about the information now coming out from the palace about everything from Kate Middleton to perhaps Prince or King Charles himself and his own medical conditions?
Yeah, I think you're right, Ciara, because like if people can't believe a photograph that has been handed out, they're not really going to believe press statements or health bulletins or updates. So it has damaged trust in a way. But look, the media will move on. There'll be something else tomorrow. There's whispers tonight already of Boris Johnson making a comeback. So it'll probably be knocked off the morning's front pages by that. It's been a sorry saga, but like what should have been the most simple of open goals to score, and they've somehow managed to score an own goal.
All right, Enda Brady, thanks for bringing us that update, as always. Well, that's it from us here on The Tonight Show. From the late team, good night to you all, and do take care.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.